With this, the first day that Justice Crooks is sitting, he was sworn in this morning.
Justice Crooks?
Crooks has been here for a while.
How quickly they forget.
Yeah, I know.
That's having much impression.
You know, in 2 years, I've been
wanting to introduce yourself.
Let's have a little decorum.
That's what we have, a little.
Yeah, very much.
We're going to do fine on the case. Because Justice Prosser is our new justice sworn in at 8:30 in an informal investiture. Formal investiture to be announced at a later date. I have introduced the court to each of our sittings today, and I have done it correctly until now. I should have stayed while I was ahead. So on my far left is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is our number six judge, Justice Patrick Crooks. Not to be confused with our new number seven. With those introductions made, I'll call 96-2816, Juneau County versus Courthouse Employees, Local 1312 et al. Mr. Elke, you represent AFSCME and others.
If it please the court, I am Bruce Elke. I am with the law firm of Schneid and Myers, and I am here today on behalf of the appellant AFSCME local unions. The lawsuit that gave rise to this appeal was commenced in October of 1995, following the unsuccessful conclusion of a lobbying campaign by the Wisconsin Counties Association. The purpose of the lobbying campaign had been to persuade the, or attempt to persuade the legislature to amend the municipal interest arbitration statute so that it would not apply to county employees. Following the unsuccessful conclusion of that lobbying effort, the governor signed into law, had signed into law an amendment of the Municipal Employment Relations Act, which had provided for continued coverage of county employees. Following that unsuccessful lobbying effort, the lawsuit in question was commenced. The basic proposition advocated by Juneau County, which was acting as the, it was a test case that was being supported by the Wisconsin Counties Association. The basic proposition was that back in 1993, 2 years earlier, when the legislature had amended the statute, the interest arbitration provisions of the statute, inadvertently it had amended the statute in a way that eliminated coverage for county employees. In other words, the entire lobbying effort had been for no purpose or hadn't been necessary. The argument was made that the amendment was such that the language of the statute since 1993 was clear and unambiguous, and that it clearly and unambiguously did not apply to county employees. The county moved for a judgment on the pleadings. The circuit court denied that motion. In part, the circuit court had before it a number of materials that had been submitted by way of affidavit, among which was a magazine article that had been written sometime earlier by one of the very attorneys who now was representing the county. And in that magazine article, the attorney had expressed the opinion that the statute as amended in 1993 had applied to public school teachers, but that as it related to county employees, they continued to be covered by the interest arbitration provisions as previously. The purpose for that, the submission of that article, was to show the court, and the court agreed that it indicated the language of the statute was not clear and unambiguous. In fact, it was clearly capable of being understood by reasonably well-informed persons, including the attorneys for the county, in a sense that was different from the sense now being argued in this lawsuit by the county. The circuit court, as I've said, denied the motion for judgment on the pleadings. The defending local unions then moved for a summary judgment, and in support of that motion, they submitted additional affidavits in which they provided various additional legislative history material, including an affidavit by Robert Lang, the head of the Fiscal Bureau, Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Based on the legislative history that was then before the circuit court, and incidentally the county, although offered the opportunity to do so, offered no evidence regarding the legislative history, no other evidence of any sort to support its position. It simply reiterated its arguments about the clear and unambiguous language of the statute.
Mr. Elke?
Yes, sir.
Forgive me for interrupting you. I should have waited until the end of your sentence. But I want to zero in on this legislative history for a moment. What exactly did you put to the, did you give to the court in terms of, quote, legislative history to support your motion?
As I saw it, Justice Pavlich, what we did was we presented two levels of legislative history, if you will. One level, which I understood or viewed as being pretty pure legislative history, was the affidavit of Lang himself. And his recitation in that affidavit of the history of the legislation in question, and his statement in that affidavit that there had never been any effort to, I shouldn't say that, because in 1995, in fact, there had been an effort. There had been amendment to the statute proposed. An amendment had been proposed that would have excluded county employees from coverage under the language of the mediation arbitration statute. That language was passed by the assembly. It had not been passed. It had been rejected by the Senate. And in conference committee, and this was all explained by Bob Lang, as a result of the conference committee, the legislature had agreed to strike the language, leaving the language as it was, that is, with broad application to county employees as well.
So there is legislative history, even though you brought it in by way of Lang's affidavit.
Yes.
But there is legislative history that indicates that an amendment which was passed by one house that would have excluded public employees other than teachers was ultimately rejected.
That is correct. And that the documents supporting that were attached to Bob Lang's affidavit. You know, the various summaries of legislation that it's his responsibility to prepare, among other things. Based on that information, the circuit court granted a motion for a summary judgment in favor of the local unions. The local unions asked the circuit court to award them their attorney fees. The contention was that the attorneys for the county and the county knew or should have known from the get-go that there was not any hope of success in this effort they were making. And the reasoning was this, and it's the reasoning that I'm arguing here today. In order to avoid looking at the legislative history, in order to avoid the situation where the court was going to look at that legislative history, the material that was provided by Mr. Lang, the county had to persuade the court that the language of the statute as written was so clear and unambiguous that it could only be read in one sense or understood in one sense by reasonably well-informed persons. And that was the fatal flaw in their argument, because they knew that that was not true, because their own attorneys had contended otherwise. And nobody is going to argue, I would think, that those attorneys were not reasonably well-informed people.
When did the attorneys do that? In that article?
In an article published in the Wisconsin Counties Association magazine.
They argued that the language was ambiguous.
No. What they did, this was back in 1993. They wrote an article that was published in Wisconsin Counties magazine, which discussed the then new amendment to the interest arbitration statute and discussed how it applied to public school teachers. Twice in that article, including once at the conclusion of it, the attorney said, as it relates to county employees, however, you still are covered. Now, there we were 2 years later, 3 years later in the circuit court, and the same attorney is arguing, oh, the language is clear and ambiguous. No person could reasonably understand this otherwise than that county employees are excluded.
Why do you put so much emphasis on that, Mr. Elke? Because, you know, lawyers are advocates. And that lawyer could well have been taking that position 1 year, and 3 years later either changed his mind or been representing the interests of the party that he's representing. I find that
is
really weak.
No, here's the proposition. It's true. Lawyers can be advocates, and as we all know, I mean, the proposition is a lawyer can argue both sides of an issue. That's not what's going on here. We're not presenting the affidavit and other materials. There were other materials, incidentally, also offered to show that, you know, this language could be understood in a different way. The reason the article is significant is, one, it's written at a time when there's no dispute. I mean, there's no reason not to express what one honestly believes to be one's opinion regarding the statutory language. And secondly, it shows that reasonably well-informed people could read and understand that statutory language in a different sense than was being advocated by Juneau County in this lawsuit. That was the significance of it. Not that the lawyer cannot make reasonable arguments one way or another, but that reasonably well-informed people could in fact make reasonable arguments both ways. And the significance is, if reasonably well-informed people, can make an argument on both sides of the issue, how does this, you know, what does this language mean, then the statute is ambiguous. And that's what they knew. They knew. I mean,
I'm following your argument. You're saying they knew that it was ambiguous, and therefore, if they'd have turned the page and looked at legislative history conclusively established that only teachers were. But now let me make a...
Yes, and they knew more than anyone else what had just transpired in the legislature just a few months earlier, where, okay.
Well, as I'm sure you're well aware, there's been a lot of proponents, led particularly by Justice Scalia, who writes that, I guess they call it a textualist argument, that in fact legislative history is extremely unreliable. Now, we have had cases in this court, and I can recall one vividly, in which both parties relied upon legislative history to establish precisely the opposite conclusions. they pointed to legislative testimony by congressmen who had voted on it. And at least my experience is that, well, there's legislative history and there's legislative history. And some of it might be okay, but some of it you have to be very careful of. And the more the legislature understands that we look at the history, the more they try to cook the books. And so I think a good argument can be made that legislative history is quite unreliable in many instances.
Well, that may be. And I have been in the situation where legislative history has been argued to support both sides of a proposition too, in the not too recent past or distant past. But here, there was no contrary legislative history. Keep in mind, when offered the opportunity to, in effect, rebut the legislative history that the local unions presented, the county stood silent. They didn't stand silent. They expressly declined to offer any alternative legislative history. Instead, they argued the language is clear and ambiguous.
Mr. Alke, if I might interrupt for a couple minutes, let me ask you what the trial judge actually did. My understanding is he granted your motion for summary judgment. He found that the action was frivolous, the action by Juneau County. But at what point did he find that it was frivolous?
What he did was he split the baby. I mean, let's be frank, that's what he did. He looked at the arguments and he said, well, I'm not going to say that they couldn't start their lawsuit, but once the briefing was done, and by it was apparent that everybody, you know, all the cards were on the table. At that point, the local unions had offered to resolve the dispute. If the offer was, if the county withdraws its complaint, we'll all walk away from this. No costs, no fees, no nothing. And instead, within a 24-hour period, the county responded, no way, we want to move forward with this thing.
Okay, now this was after the briefing was done, though, and after the affidavits had been submitted and everything?
After the affidavits had been submitted, which showed that reasonable informed people could understand this language in a different sense. And it was at that point, before the final argument was had and before the decision was made denying the motion for judgment on the pleadings, it was at that point that the judge said, you should have accepted the offer that the union had made. Because at that point it was clear to everybody which way this was going. And I think the judge had in mind, and I don't recall right now if he expressly said this or not, he had in mind, I think, the fact that the county had not offered any legislative history to rebut that offer by the union. And in fact, he commented that all that you've done is reiterate the arguments you had made earlier in this case.
Aren't there many rules of statutory construction, that can be used to rebut the rule of using legislative history, i.e., this was an unintended result, it was an absurd result? In other words, there seems to be rules out there that can counter every other rule. You throw a rule at me and I can throw another rule at you that counters what you say. And that legislative history is just one example whereby we can say, okay, legislative history establishes this, but then on the other hand, the legislature could not have intended such an absurdity in the facts that we have before us, and therefore they couldn't have intended
it. There are a variety of rules out there for interpreting statutes, but I don't understand those rules to be applied as an alternative to legislative history. My understanding of it is this. The first line of attack is the statute clear and unambiguous, or can it be understood by reasonable informed people in more than one sense? If the answer to that is no, then you can go to another step.
Yeah, but there's another thrust. This plain language, and then the other parry is that even though it's plain,
yes,
that there may be an hidden ambiguity.
Yes.
Or that this is leads to an absurd result. I mean, there's always...
Right, that's what I was getting to, is that there are a number of steps in the analysis that you can go through. You look at the context of the statute, you look at the result, is it absurd? Those are, and as I see it, you go through that analysis before you get to the legislative history. And the legislative history itself is the last resort. What the courts will try to do first is determine the meaning of the language, first from the language itself, then from its context, and then from its impact, the result. And if it appears, as when you've gone through that analysis, that the statutory language is still ambiguous, then as a last resort, you go to the legislative history. You try to determine from what the legislators said or did what the language means. And so the point here is that we were at the last step. I mean, the language was not clear. The context did not tell us one way or another clearly what the language meant. And we didn't really argue the result issue, because the court didn't get that far.
I don't understand the circuit court's reasoning. Now, lawyers, the test is whether a lawyer knew or should have known that it was not worth arguing. That's a shorthand way of doing it. So one assumes that the lawyer is held to have examined the legislative history, should have examined it. Therefore, the lawyer should have known this legislative history. Whether the lawyer did or did not becomes irrelevant under the should have known. So if you take that approach and you then decide that on the basis of this legislative history, it's frivolous, I don't see how the judge can cut the baby in this case, because you didn't, with all due respect to counsel, didn't point up anything, if this is what you've said, that a careful lawyer, a reasonable lawyer, wouldn't have readily found. I mean, it wasn't like you had to turn over every piece of paper in the Capitol.
Exactly, and that's why we cross-appealed on that issue, because we thought, our view is that they knew what the legislative history was going into the lawsuit, and they knew that the language was capable of being reasonably, being understood differently. And so if they had really made that, if they had given thought to that at all, if they had done the analysis that they should have done, the lawsuit never would have been commenced.
What do you think the Court of Appeals opinion stands for? I mean, if you're going to summarize it, what's the rule of law, and what is it that you want this court to say?
What we would like you to say is that actions that are commenced as declaratory judgment actions are no different from any other lawsuit as it concerns the application of the frivolous claim statute. It's that simple. This case would have been more ambiguous, if you will, if the Court of Appeals had said, we think that some consideration should be given to the nature of the declaratory judgment statute when you are assessing whether or not a claim is frivolous, and remanded it. If they had done that, I think we would have had a little bit different, we'd be here in a different posture.
Well, what do you think the Court of Appeals said?
They said the circuit court failed to take into account that this was a declaratory judgment action, judgment reversed. That's what they said.
Well, what significance did they give to the declaratory judgment action?
Well, it appears they gave dispositive significance to it. I mean, they give no other reason for reversing the circuit court judgment other than the proposition that declaratory judgment actions are to be liberally construed.
Where do you find that in the opinion?
It's towards the end of the...
They talk about the four-part test of pension
right.
management being met.
Yeah. Yeah, that's at page 112 of the appendix.
Yeah, I'm reading.
Yeah. I was just going to say that, or just ask, as I understood it, they said that there is a justiciable controversy. This is what the appellate court said, and that it was reasonable for the county to go ahead and indicate that this is the way we feel that the statute supports our interpretation. I mean, that's what they did. It wasn't so. And that's the way they always do things. Though. I mean, there isn't any new standard here, is there?
Except that they've tossed in as a factor the declaratory judgment action. And the fact that it's a judicial justiciable controversy, as I pointed out in a footnote to our brief at page 20, that's neither here nor there in terms of whether the claim is frivolous. All that you look for to determine whether or not there's a justiciable controversy is whether there's a claim being made and whether there's somebody who has an interest in opposing it. But that doesn't tell you that the claim has merit or is going to be successful or, conversely, is frivolous. All it tells you is that it's justiciable.
Getting back to legislative history for a moment, I'm not sure you want, the group that you represent wants the decision that you are arguing here for, because in the legislature, as you well know, having worked with the legislature, a reason for defeating, for instance, an amendment that you referred to might well be because some legislators believed that it was unnecessary, that it was already covered by the statute. And it seems to me that when you're going into court to argue a position with respect to declaratory judgment, what does a statute mean? You shouldn't be bound solely by legislative history. Because it seems to me you'd be more often in the position of arguing for a statute in which possibly legislative history is contrary to your side than the other.
Well,
it seems to me you're asking for a... You're really trying to narrow the grounds upon which people can go into court.
No, I would disagree with that.
Are you uncomfortable with that, and if not, why not?
In this case, keep in mind, first, legislative history, and the county argues it, and the circuit court argued it in terms of evidence, and I don't disagree with that. It's evidence. It's evidence at one level or another of the legislature's intention. And so it is not necessarily dispositive evidence, but it is evidence. But when there's no contrary evidence, then it's dispositive. I mean, remember, the frivolous claims statute is there's no basis in fact or law.
Well, if we write that, Mr. Elke, then the next case, what's to stop your opponent from getting some legislator to swear out an affidavit to the circuit court that, in fact, in his mind, he believed that the exact opposite was the truth?
Well,
was true. Aren't we then getting into swearing contests?
That kind of evidence is generally understood not to be competent history or evidence of legislative history. On the other hand, the evidence we tried to tailor our evidence.
Stand in front of the microphone, please. You're being recorded.
Okay. We tried to present evidence that was consistent with the kind of evidence this court has previously accepted as being legitimate legislative history, and that's one reason why we went to Mr. Lang.
Well, let me put it this way, see if I don't get it with Justice Malvich's. You've got language in the statute that would seem to indicate one result, right? You got legislative history that seems to indicate another, right?
Actually, we thought the language of the statute, one of the arguments we made in the circuit court was that the language of the statute is in fact clear, and it favors our position. If you read it a certain way.
If you read it a certain way, okay. You could read it one way and it favors your position. You could read it another way and it doesn't favor your position. Do you accept that for the moment?
Yes. Yes.
You agree with that?
Yes.
All right. So to decide that your position, your reading of it is correct, you look to an extrinsic matter, which is legislative history, which proves what you said. But in a lawsuit, you don't know necessarily what the court's going to say. The court could say, we agree with the other reading on its plain meaning, right?
It could, yes.
It could. And as soon as you say it could, and if I'll press you further, reasonably could say that, then it's not frivolous. I mean, that's the ultimate argument for the reasoning that we're trying to raise with you. Because if you had, and maybe we could even go farther and say anytime you have a statute by nature and you have to interpret it by nature, you don't have a frivolous action because there's so many potential interpretations.
Well, you're right. I mean, you're right to the extent that you're suggesting that there's no clear, as they say, bright line. But the fact of the matter is, in this case, there was no contrary evidence offered. None. Zero.
But they didn't fold. The other side did not fold. They didn't take their tents and go home and say,
no.
You got us, they said. You know,
but maybe they should have. So that's the proposition.
That's the issue.
And that's the issue here. Okay. I'm out of time.
Great. You have time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel? Hazelbaker.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. Mark Hazelbaker of Belk, Earhart & Moore here for Juneau County. May I say at the beginning, I wish to congratulate Justice Proster on his appointment to the court. It's a pleasure to see you there, sir. And it's an honor to be here today. You may recall, members of the court, that several terms ago, the United States Supreme Court issued a rather famous case, now the Daubert case, involving whether or not so-called junk science ought to be admissible without any prudent limitations, or whether in fact the trial judges ought to exercise some supervisory control to limit that which was being advanced in support of certain propositions to science that had some scientific validity. Well, to give you an analogous consideration that's before us today, I think one of the issues that is of concern in this case is junk history. That is to say, a plethora of information being advanced supposedly as evidence of what the legislature intended that in fact has nothing at all to do with what the legislature intended. The affidavit of Robert Lang is a good example of that. Mr. Lang's affidavit was not in front of the legislature when they considered the statute in question. And I find it ironic that Mr. Elke concedes that a legislator cannot write an affidavit construing a statute. That's black letter law in Wisconsin under Sharp versus Cartwright. But the director of the Legislative Fiscal Bureau can? That doesn't quite make sense to me. There is a limited amount of material generated in this legislative process in Wisconsin that has some useful weight in the defining what the history of the legislature is. I submit to you that that's actually quite limited, and I submit to you that it would be a mistake for Wisconsin to follow the path that the federal courts have followed, where it seems like when you read U.S. Supreme Court opinions, even in the case of unambiguous statutes, they still dredge out the congressional news and debate on the floor of Congress to try to gild the lily. All that does, frankly, is prompt the legislative process to generate more and more and more frippery that doesn't necessarily get laws passed and, in fact, serves to cloud the result. What we want to do is make every rule of construction focus to the degree possible on giving the legislators an incentive to say what they mean. Because ultimately, the product of legislation should be a law that, when printed in a bound volume like that, has the same utility to someone working in Park Falls as someone who, like me, has the office across the Capitol.
The council, legislators frequently intentionally don't say what they mean.
Oh, yeah.
In order to get the votes to pass a bill and leave it to the courts to interpret.
And that's where, as you know, Justice Babich used to be a lobbyist too in my early part of my career. At some of the time during which you were in the Senate, we both would agree that sometimes the only way to get a political issue resolved is to fudge the language a little bit. And yeah, we do have to resort to construction. And that's, I think, where this case comes in. Because we all know that although we want the legislature to do the best job they can in making clear statutes, they don't always do that. We have to sometimes go back and try to figure out what they meant. Or sometimes, as this case presents, we have to take the proposition that the statute says something, and it may seem contrary to what popular opinion perceived at the time that it was enacted, but boy, we need to know whether or not this particular construction of statutes is valid.
Mr. Hazelbaker, at the point when the judge denied your client's motion for judgment on the pleadings, and as I understand it, ruled that the statute was ambiguous, at that point, don't you think it would have been appropriate, if you had legislative history on your side, to present that legislative history?
Absolutely, and in fact...
And yet your client presented nothing, right?
The record references a letter that I wrote to Judge McMonigle indicating that we did not have any legislative history to present in addition to what had already been filed. I would point out, though, that isn't where our efforts stopped. And this is a point that I don't think has come out very clearly, because it's not correct to state that after the point in time where the judgment on the pleadings was denied, we did nothing. We did, in fact, make an argument to Judge McMonigle that an additional way of construing the statute could be by reference to its interaction with other subdivisions in the statute. We filed a letter brief to that effect in opposition to the union's motion for summary judgment. And that joined issue on a substantive point, and it raises an issue that I'd like to cover real briefly, which is that in terms of construction of statutes, the accepted methodology in Wisconsin considers legislative history as only one of a series of sources for the meaning of a statute. Obviously, the plain meaning is the first, but as the Court of Appeals held in the matter of Trutchell, 208 Wisconsin 2nd, 361, which is a very recent case, and I quote, however, if the language used in the statute is capable of more than one meaning, this court will determine legislative intent from the words of the statute in relation to its context, subject matter, scope, history, and the object which the legislature intended to accomplish. Now, those are competing sources by which the intention of the legislature can be determined. Sometimes legislative history either is non-existent or it's inconclusive. I think you made a good point, Justice Babich, when you said that it's possible to produce, in some cases anyway, history on both sides of a question. That takes us back to the cliche that, in many respects, history is what is told by the victors. But this problem of how we parse the language of statutes is a very, very old one. It just by coincidence, this weekend I was reading from the book Hasidur HaShalem, which is a Hebrew prayer book, and I came to a point in the morning service, which is called the Talmudic Exposition of the Scriptures. And it said, Rabbi Ishmael wrote, "The Torah is interpreted by means of 13 rules," and I think you'll recognize some of these. One, inference is drawn from a minor premise to a major one, or from a major premise to a minor one. And then it goes on. Number four, when a generalization is followed by a specification, only what is specified applies. Now, if you put these in Latin, you'd be coming up with some things like eustem generis, etc. So, obviously, this whole issue has been going on since the Torah was given at Sinai, if not longer. And it is probably never going to be concluded. The point I make simply is that we have to go with what we have. What we have are accepted doctrines of statutory interpretation, one of which is that
Counsel,
if you can't figure out what something means, then look at it in its total context, and that's what
Counsel,
we try to do.
Is it your position that any time you have statutory interpretation, it can't be frivolous?
Well, I think that that would be stating the proposition a little bit too broadly. I think that there are some, that, for example, if I filed a complaint alleging I'm about to get in my car and I know that there will be an octagonal red sign at a corner very soon in my path, I'd like to know whether or not I have to stop. That's probably frivolous because I think any layperson would realize the impact of that statute. In the context of a case...
Somebody is chasing you with a gun, shooting at your car. That's a fact situation. Cop gives you a ticket for failing to stop.
Well, what I said was, does the statute, bringing an action to question, does the statute apply in this context?
But you don't, that's right. Put it into the context. So I'm raising
the question ultimately is...
I'm helping you, counsel.
I understand that. what I'm trying to say is that the purpose of having a declaratory judgment statute is to let people look before they leap. All right? And I pointed out in my brief, and I feel very strongly about the fact that with Mr. Elke's cooperation, and he and I have had a good and long professional relationship, we were able to get this case litigated in a very austere manner. And that's the whole point of having a statute. The suggestion you made, Justice Babich, is the right one, which is that the union is the last body that should want the statute to be construed narrowly, because the unions have been vigorous in their use of not just this statute, but other statutes to try to expand the envelope of the law. Bruce Elke and I have worked on a number of cases together where we've tried some cutting-edge questions in the law.
But here, counsel, I mean, this is... They obviously feel very seriously about this issue, or they wouldn't be here. Mr. Elke wouldn't be here. And it seems to me, maybe reading between the lines, maybe it doesn't require much reading between the lines, they're saying, hey, they knew. They knew from the beginning. They had even tried to get an amendment passed. They knew what that statute meant. There were no reasonable people could disagree. And you forced us to use money and time and energy, etc., to go into court on a case you knew you were going to lose. And this is where the line ought to be drawn. How do you answer that? That you knew you were going to lose?
Well, first of all, I would readily concede that this case is about a lot more than what's on the surface. I think it's very clear that this case is about a very broad and bitter rivalry between the two parent organizations involved here, Council 40 and the AFSCME Council on the one side and the Counties Association on the other. But as to the merits of this, I can tell you I certainly had a good faith interest in trying to establish this proposition. I won't apologize for the fact that I'd like to see binding arbitration repealed, and it wasn't repealed apparently by the legislature, but I fully believe that what the legislature enacts, it intends. And I believe that we had a good faith argument that the legislature adopted language that had the effect of taking county employees out of the statute. Now, what people know in Madison about what the legislature did, that's like the old parable of the blind man and the elephant. I don't mean to use a partisan metaphor, but everybody has their own view. I'm sure you can recall, sir, from caucuses and floor action that you'd think everybody thought something else happened. So, we get back to that problem of history being what the victors tell about the battle. I'm concerned that if we put so much on this idea of what did the counties association know and when did they know it, we're going to wind up chilling litigants.
Well, this may be an unfair question, and if it is, I apologize in advance. Why didn't you appeal?
I'm sorry?
Why didn't you appeal the interpretation of the statute?
The only thing before this court is the cost and fees for frivolous.
Right.
And that was the only thing before the Court of Appeals. That's...
Well, why didn't you appeal to the Court of Appeals?
Right.
I think that the answer to that question is that we felt that we had the opportunity to litigate the case to the trial judge. I also point out that in addition to making an argument about the statute's plain language, we also made the argument that I referenced that the interaction of the statute with its subdivisions could be read to read the county employees out of the law. I guess we were satisfied that Judge McMonigle's answer was a good answer. We wanted to have an answer from a judge. We wanted to get somebody outside of both sides, somebody who's impartial, to give us an answer. And frankly, that's why we have a court system. It's part of the responsibility of the courts to help settle these questions. Perhaps not a pleasant one all the time, but that's where we felt the need to get this. And I might add that it's referenced in Mr. Elke's briefing that there was another lawsuit brought at about the same time also in Juneau County. It wasn't, as Mr. Elke suggested, commenced at the initiative of Juneau County, but attorney Fred Hollenbeck of the Curran Law Firm in Boston read the statute, came to the same conclusion, and brought his own declaratory judgment action on behalf of his clients seeking the same result and got the same outcome. My point is that there was a question out there. It was a question that had occurred to a number of people, and it was a question that needed to be answered. It was answered. We moved on.
You're here, in effect, saying the Court of Appeals did right.
Yes.
It did right by result. Now, how do you read the Court of Appeals decision? And do you think we should just adopt the Court of Appeals decision and not bother right our own? Would you keep the same result but change something in the language, or how would you suggest we write it? So it's really two questions. One, is anything the matter? How do you read the Court of Appeals decision? And two, what do you want this court to write other than the bottom line, which I understand?
Well, it's always tempting to stick with the result that you like, and I know it's hazardous to suggest that this court simply adopt the Court of Appeals reasoning, but more to the point, it seems to me that the Court of Appeals did not, as Mr. Elke suggested, craft a new test. That's an argument that Mr. Elke and I have debated before on most, if not some, of the cases that we've had before, and it's a good argument. But in this case, they didn't adopt a new test. They simply applied the frivolous case statute in a new context, that of a declaratory judgment action. What they said was, do you have a justiciable controversy? All four elements were met here. And I might add that if the unions felt so strongly about this matter at the outset, then I'm somewhat surprised that in their own responsive pleading, they prayed for a declaratory judgment action, finding that it was unambiguous and in their favor, and did not, at that time at least, move for the sanction that they now seek. More to the point, what the Court of Appeals said basically is, in this kind of a situation, declaratory relief serves the function of allowing parties to obtain a determination by a court of record as to what a statute means in the context in which they are acting. That's what we did, and that's what they endorsed. As far as what this court does, most importantly, I think that any decision from this court needs to be very clear as to two things. First of all, I think it needs to be tread very cautiously in terms of the interaction between legislative activity of an association, which is a protected activity under the First Amendment, and that association's subsequent activity in litigation. I would be very, very dismayed to see a rule adopted which, in effect, tied the hands of an association by what it should have picked up on from the legislative ambience and said it's bad faith to pursue litigation aimed at coming up with any result that is contrary to what you should have known happened. Okay? I think that's a dangerous rule, and I think that it will be felt quite harshly by a number of people, not just the county's association. Secondly, I think that this case ought to stand for the proposition that when statutory interpretation is required, that to the degree we hold counsel to an ethical obligation to research and review what is out there by way of statutory construction, the universe that they are obligated to consider should not include interviewing Bob Lang, for example. That's what I would have had to do to verify the bona fides of my complaint in order to meet Mr. Elke's objection, because I didn't have that affidavit and it wasn't on file anywhere at the time this action was started. I don't think that we want people to be subjected to that kind of a standard. I think we want what the court has laid down since the Summers versus Carr case, holding that a reasonable attorney looking at a case objectively should conclude that this case has arguable merit. Maybe not that you're sure you're going to win, but that it has arguable merit.
Let me tell you what my problem is, as I see it with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals says that there are four conditions to maintaining a proper action. That's under the Declaratory Judgment Act. None of that, I think, relates to whether it's frivolous, because even a frivolous action will fit all of those. So you then get to that's the first part, as to whether you have a good uniform declaratory judgment.
If I may interject, Madam Justice, if you're saying that the mere fact that your complaint states a claim does not mean that it is not frivolous, I agree with that.
That's right. And that's what the first one says, is the justiciable controversy, that it's a claim of right. The second one is a controversy is between persons whose interests are adverse. That was true here. That they have a legal interest that is legally protectable. That was true here. And that it must be ripe. And that's a ripeness issue, and it was ripe. I don't think anyone's debating that. So then on page 8, I'm at 108 of the appendix, the Court of Appeals discusses 814.025, which is the frivolous action one, and then it handles that in two paragraphs. And I didn't check on Kelly v. Clark, but that's a Court of Appeals thing. It says, when a party's claim can be determined only after research and deliberation, it is not frivolous. Do you agree with that?
Well, I have the Kelly version.
A lawyer can just file something just because she can't find out that she's wrong until she's had research and deliberation, that it's not frivolous?
Well, I've read the Kelly case response, and I have it here in front of me. What I believe the Kelly case is saying is that a proposition for the purpose of establishing the bona fides of the counsel bringing it is not frivolous if it's an issue that's complex enough that you should have to do a little digging to figure out whether or not it's right. I think that position, stated as simply as it's stated in the Court of Appeals decision, may go too far, because I handle prisoner cases, and they require a lot of research to get rid of. Doesn't mean they're not frivolous.
And then it says, one party's contention of the other's action is frivolous reflects more about the nature of litigation than it does about the merits of the allegations. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that it's possible that parties may use these kinds of contentions back and forth.
I know, but
there's certainly...
I know they do that, but it's not always true.
I agree.
I mean, what I'm trying to do is read three sentences that are the holding in this case, or explain the rationale. And the third sentence is, and finally, all claims are presumed to be non-frivolous.
Well, that, I think, accurately states the law.
But it's rebuttable, isn't it?
It is a rebuttable presumption, of course. But I think that what I read the Court of Appeals saying is that it appears that there's a substantial issue that's at bar, that this is enough to give rise to the duty of to satisfy the attorney's obligation. I don't think that it would be a plausible reading of the frivolous costs statute to invoke it only post hoc, because after all, we have an obligation as attorneys to review pleadings before we sign them to make sure that they are supported by a good faith argument for extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, or by the law as it currently stands, and by the facts. In this case, in discharging that obligation, we looked at the law, we looked at what we thought to be dispositive of the procedural history of the statute in the legislature, and frankly, I spent quite a bit of time looking at a dictionary and trying to figure out grammatically what this statute meant, and I think I came to a plausible construction in my mind of what it meant. It was an appositive clause that appeared to provide a specific limiter to a general introductory clause. That's why, by the way, I picked out that particular rule of construction that I did.
I don't, I'm not attacking that, and but I am worried about how to write an opinion, because that's ultimately what one of us is going to have to do. And then when I went through the other parts of this opinion, there was a review of all the evidence given and an explanation of its strengths and weaknesses, but as I read this opinion, every single one of the things presented by the union was admissible and relevant. Strength could be debated about that. Then I got to the top of 112, and I think this is where at least some people interpret the opinion. Furthermore, this is after this all this evidence has been reviewed, and that it's relevant. Furthermore, when the lawsuit has been commenced pursuant to 806.04 stats in regard to a statute that has not been construed in a published case, the historic liberal construction of 806.04 must be considered. So it looks as if the Declaratory Judgment Act has a heavy hand in the interpretation of this opinion.
I think it went, the way I read it, and this is only my reading, was that as the frivolous cost statute needs to be applied in a number of different contexts, it has to be applied in this one. It doesn't, to my mind, impose an absolute and unchanging obligation. It imposes an obligation that invariably varies a little bit by the context. If somebody came to me and they asked me to commit...
I'm going to pinpoint that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Do you think the fact that this is a declaratory judgment case makes a difference in determining frivolousness?
I think it makes a difference in that the substance of the claim necessary to pass 802.05 is different.
Okay. So it does matter.
Yes, it does.
This had been not a declaratory judgment matter. It might have been different. Needn't be, but it might have been.
Sure. Just like if you brought if somebody came to you and asked you to file a claim under Rule 10b-5 of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is an extremely complex matter. You know, I think the reasonable attorney most often would say, let me refer you. And that's the kind of point that I'm making. In this context, the analysis has to be governed by the nature of the object of the representation.
I don't understand your answer when you say the substance that makes a difference, that is the declaratory judgment action, that it is an action, makes a difference in this case because the substance of the claim, what do you mean by that?
What I'm saying is that the object of a declaratory judgment action is to obtain clarification of the law's application to a set of facts in the context of a controversy that is ripe for judicial determination, but does not yet necessarily involve something that has actually happened yet. By definition, when you're trying to evaluate a transaction before it is transacted, so you're not going to have as much factual material, certainly, and you may not have as much much certainty as to the context. It's a lot bigger a situation.
By nature of the type of action, we may not have lots of discovery and evidence to present. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and you simply don't have the kind of structure that you do if you wait until after the fact and you have a defined universe of transactions and facts to refer to. That's my point. And that by definition, that makes it a lot more problematic to decide, do you or do you not have the grounds to proceed? It also, I think, and it goes back to this point that I was trying to make earlier, which is that the significance of this issue is far broader than this case, and that is that ultimately, I don't see how anything that this court does, regardless of the result, can stand if it has the effect of in any way deterring people from bringing important questions before the courts. Now, when I say important questions, I'm not trying to say that the question of whether or not I have to stop for the next stop sign would necessarily be an important question, but this is an important question. The issue of binding arbitration has been before this court before in the Milwaukee County case. I'm sure that aspects of it will be before this court again. But it may not be binding arbitration tomorrow that comes up. It might be the application of a statute in a complex area to another area of endeavor. It may very well be the very people that Mr. Elke represents who will be in front of the court asking for declaratory relief.
Counsel, in looking at what was known or should have been known, it seems to me at least that it's quite significant that one house of the legislature passed an amendment. That amendment would have achieved what your client was arguing for, and that amendment never became law. Was that not significant to the trial judge in finding the action frivolous?
To be honest with you, I can't remember to what weight the trial judge gave to that point. However, I will say that...
Well, let me ask you, do you find that significant?
I find it of note, and I find it worth considering. However, as the point was made, and it's certainly been my experience that judging what statutes mean on the basis of legislation which has been rejected is a very hazardous task, because at its extreme, there are something like 1,800 bills every session that aren't enacted, and I doubt that it would be plausible to assert that each and every one of those should stand as proof of what the statutes do not already say.
Sometimes.
However, this was an amendment to the statute that was being argued about here, was it not? Isn't that a little more significant than 1,800 bills that are rejected each session?
Well, it's the same thing. It's the failure of the legislature to enact language that changes the statute, leaving the language that existed before in place. The degree to which one can safely rely on the non-adoption of a statute as proof that the legislature must have intended to not change the law, or that they must have concluded the law does not already say that, is quite limited.
In other words, the legislature might have thought an amendment wasn't needed.
Well,
it was already said it.
It's like the Oracle at Delphi.
One house didn't, apparently, huh?
That's right. It's like the Oracle at Delphi. You can find a lot of meanings from it, none of which may be right or all of which may be right. The legislature is a complex, interesting, fascinating institution, and that's why I think we know that the plain meaning rule is by far the safest way in assessing statutory construction, because it's the one area in which subjective considerations are arguably the most removed.
The trouble is that words have usually more than one meaning.
Well, that's right. And the other problem, of course, is that there's a cultural context for almost all statutes. I think it's now been repealed, but there used to be one of my favorites, nonsensical statutes, the one in Chapter 172, Rams may be taken up liability. And if you ever read that, it was, I think Justice Prosser is nodding familiarity with it. At one point, that statute probably meant something, because it talked about posting a notice containing the marks of the ram and all these other terms that have lost their meaning historically. That's what we're struggling with in terms of trying to figure out statutes. We're looking at, from our perspective, what a group of people working in this building thought they were doing, and sometimes we're doing little more than hazarding a guess. In this case, what we were trying to do was get a determination. Yes, trying to get a determination favorable to my client. That's it. We have every right to do that. In this system of justice, one of the things that for which courts exist is to advance your interests on a public policy question. I don't apologize for that. I don't think Mr. Elke would apologize for it either. Obviously, we are bound by our duty as counsel to have a good faith basis for proceeding. That was present here. We may not have won, but we had the right to ask the question.
How much money is involved here?
Well, the award of attorney's fees was, I believe, about $8,000, although I'm not clear. Was it 11? $8,000. Let's put it this way. It's certainly less than the cost of briefing this case and arguing it.
That was my point.
What weight should be given to the fact that an offer of settlement was made and you went on after that?
That's a good question. Frankly, I think that offering to settle the case at the time that Mr. Elke offered it, it was a gesture of good faith on his part. I would never characterize Mr. Elke otherwise. But he was asking us to drop our lawsuit after we'd done all the briefing, and when the motion hearing on our motion for judgment and the pleadings was only 13 days away. That seems to me to be a little bit abrupt. Beyond that point, had we really had nothing else to say about the matter, it might have had some bearing. But I reiterate that we did in fact make a bona fide point that this statute could be construed in other methods, using other methods than resort to legislative history. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Hazelbaker. Mr. Elke?
I always thought the statute governing Ludafisk was the most important statute in our books. Ludafisk, you know, is a dangerous substance.
It's a pollutant. Yes, you were here.
The argument is made that you have to affirm the appeals court, otherwise bad things will happen. This case is fairly simple and straightforward. At some point, a line has to be drawn where you decide to seek a declaratory judgment.
Mr. Elke, you have a point to make. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your point.
Well, what I wanted to say is this. I mean, the argument was prefaced with saying, we went forward with this lawsuit because we wanted the answer from the judge. Well, there is not a single lawsuit that is commenced that you cannot say that about. Every lawsuit seeks a judge's answer. And if that is the defense to a claim being frivolous, then the frivolous judgment statute means nothing. And this lawsuit is different from your ordinary, from a personal injury lawsuit or from a lawsuit involving an ordinance or perhaps a dispute over a will or the meaning of a contract. It's different only in that it is legislative history that is the evidence. That's what's different.
Well, Mr. Elke, let me pursue that with a hypothetical. Let's assume that an important labor bill is working its way through the legislature. And you have in prior statements and in publications, at least internal publications, stated that you believe that that there is a residency requirement and that you should try to knock it out. You know what I mean by a residency requirement.
Yes.
Yeah. And so you put in an amendment to try to knock it out that says clearly that residency cannot be a condition of employment, etc. And you fail. So you've got this, you've got documents, you've got speeches, you've got legislative history. Do you believe you should be held to that position if the statute, when you go into court to try to get the court to declare that a residency requirement is not a part of the statute?
Do I believe I should be,
yeah,
or do I believe I will be? I believe I will be, and I can tell you that when my clients come to me and they say, we tried to bargain this and we couldn't get it, now we want you to go to arbitration and try to get it that way, I have never yet told them we'll do that. I always